This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. After we announced our plan to get all of you to write a commencement address, we got an email from a man named Orlo Schroyer, the Deputy Commissioner of Education in Missouri's Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, a man who's spoken at several graduations, and he sent us what he uses to open. He calls it an icebreaker. After one graduation speech, a student handed me a note, some remarks, I thought, about what I'd just said. Instead, it had this poem. Graduation time is here, and soon, from place to place, all the commencement speakers will be telling us what we face. We face some tough decisions, including how we dress. We face many paths ahead. One could lead us to success. We should face the future brightly and withhold our pride a bit. But in the midst of all this talking, we just sit and sit and sit. Well, we promise to keep it short, but it's going to take all of you the better part of an hour to write it. We want more emails at totn@npr.org, and we want your calls, 800-989-8255. We're going to provide professional guidance on structure and mechanics and performance. We're also going to hear from a couple of commencement veterans. At the end of the show, we'll assemble your ideas into the TOTN 2003 commencement address. So we really do need to hear from you. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and that email address again is totn@npr.org. And let's begin with Pamela, who joins us from Boulder, Colorado.
Hello, Neil.
Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I just returned from my daughter's graduation in Ithaca, New York, and we had as speakers Ben and Jerry, the ice cream magnates.
Mm-hmm.
What was especially interesting was that Jerry spoke first, spoke briefly, and was terrific. He explained how their business had been formed, but most importantly, he told the kids that if they didn't like the status quo, they should challenge it and change it. And they were great examples of this. And this is what the kids liked hearing, and certainly what the parents liked hearing.
Uh-huh.
The other half, when Ben spoke, it was, shall we say, a bit of a disaster.
What did he have to say?
Ben did an anti-war speech, and the kids were very upset about this because it had nothing to do with them, and in essence what, well, when I say nothing to do with them, obviously it did have a lot to do with them, but they felt it was inappropriate for their graduation. He took a great deal of time to do this, which also bothered them because the way their graduation was set up, they stood as individual schools, and even the summa cum laudes were not mentioned individually. And there were so many veterans in the audience that it was very upsetting to them to be sitting there and be a captive audience for something that they felt was not directly related to their kids' future.
Well, I'm sorry it all didn't work out so well, but congratulations to you and your daughter.
Thank you very much. And in many ways, I think it did work out. It was just unfortunate to see kids and faculty standing up and walking out.
Yes, I'm not sure that that's the only time that's happened this particular graduation season. And topicality, I guess, is one of the issues we're going to have to discuss.
Thank you. And I think that the key, as you mentioned earlier, is keeping it short and sweet for the kids.
Okay, Pamela. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Here's an email we got from Norma Halley, age 17, in Clarence Center, New York. I actually graduated from high school yesterday evening. This came in earlier in the week. Our keynote speaker was an alumna of the school, Narden Academy, in Buffalo, New York, and she said a lot of things. One in particular stuck in my mind. She mentioned a teacher at the school when she went there who always said, change involves movement, movement involves friction. Our speaker continued to say that friction is what causes things to crumble, but it is also what polishes fine gemstones. So a piece of advice from a graduation ceremony in Buffalo. We mentioned some professional advice. Well, joining us to help craft our commencement speech is Kenneth Baer former speechwriter for Al Gore and now a professional communications and speechwriting consultant. He's already written two commencement speeches this year for clients, and his secret love of watching commencement speeches on C-SPAN television also adds to his air of authority on the subject. He's with us here in Studio 3A, and welcome to Talk of the Nation's speechwriting class.
Thank you, Neil. Thank you.
We need to keep in mind that a commencement speech is in some ways different from other speeches.
It is very different. Because it's probably one of the first times and only times in American life when we have people who know a lot, and we ask them not to talk about what they know, but actually to impart wisdom to students. And as the first caller talked about, it's really a time for them to inspire and not necessarily to harangue or to educate. That was done in the lecture halls for 4 years, and now it's time for something different.
Are there different kinds of commencement speeches?
Yeah, I think there's really three types of commencement speeches. There's one in which the speaker gives advice explicitly. Says, there's the four things I think you need to know,
right,
and kind of structure it that way. The second one is when you lay out a large social challenge, which is ahead, which these graduates will be facing, give a perspective on it. So it could be war, or it could be intolerance, it could be the state of public education.
A theme.
Exactly, a theme. And those tend not to be as funny or interesting as the first one. And the third one is rarely used, and only a small group of people can give it, and that's when you use the students as a backdrop for a larger policy announcement. George Marshall did this in 1947 at Harvard when he laid out the Marshall Plan. Even this year at University of South Carolina, George Bush laid out at that commencement ceremony his vision for Middle East trade and peace. And only if you have that stature, generally, do students tolerate that sort of speech.
Our speaker today does not have that sort of stature, and this will not be the sort of speech we're giving. What we do need, though, an outline from you. Now, what are the elements, the things that you need to compose to go into a commencement speech?
Well, depending which way you go, of course, depends on a lot of things, depending where you are and depending who you are. But generally, you need to open up and need to sort of, as William Safire puts it, shake hands with the audience, maybe tell a joke. Mario Cuomo, in one of his favorite commencement speeches at Iona College in 1984, said this joke, which is an oldie but goodie. He said he was told that commencement speakers should think of themselves as like a body at a wake. They need you in order to have a party, but you really should. Nobody expects you to really say very much. And as that first caller said, it's all about brevity. It's very important. Hmm. After that, you need to acknowledge the parents and family and friends. This is really not just about the graduates, but everyone who got them there. And sometimes they paid a lot of money in order to get there, and so they really feel like they need to be thanked too. And then you need to lay out very quickly what your speech is going to be about. And that's what I guess our callers today are going to figure out.
That's what we need from you. Here's a, I guess the opening joke is the icebreaker.
I always like stealing jokes.
Jeff Waddell in Jacksonville, Florida, just emails us with, learn this lesson. There's always somebody out there who is stronger, smarter, faster, dumber, better looking, more talented, and less talented than you. And, advice to graduates, always bring a towel. You know, these sorts of things go over pretty well. My father gave me wonderful advice when I left home back in 1962. It was especially nice because I was a female going out on my own alone. His advice remains with me today. It was, quit a few jobs and see the world. Hope you like it. That from Lila Colley Minor. The career advice is always a big part of this, isn't it?
I think so, especially if you're speaking to undergrads as opposed to graduates getting professional degrees who haven't been out there yet, and especially right now graduating to a bad economy. So any sort of advice of how to get there, don't worry, things will be okay, and your philosophy degree is probably just as good as the guy with the accounting degree down the row from you.
The salutarian at our recent high school graduation told his classmates, writes Ann Moskrip in New Plymouth, Idaho, don't get a job. After the cheering died down, he restated, don't get a job, get a career, find something you love and do it. That's the familiar turnaround, isn't it?
It is a familiar one, and it's also familiar but pretty sound advice, I think.
Get out there and get a job. You'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll make minimum wage. That's suggested by Stuart Nelson. And I've seen this countless times. This from Andrew J. Sather. For the A and B students, good job. Keep up the good work. For the C and D students, you too can become president of the United States. Let's get a suggestion now from Rye in Durham, Connecticut.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
I just graduated from Smith College this past weekend, and I actually gave the student address as class president. And one thing.
Congratulations on both counts.
Thank you. One thing I said when a friend of mine told me she wanted to hear something that made her feel less terrified, I thought about it and realized that all of it is about, you know, passing of time. So I came up with that 4 years ends every day, and it's just a matter of remembering where it starts. And that got a pretty good response. So I just wanted to pass that on to your listeners.
Sort of the variation on today's the first day of the rest of your life.
Right.
Okay. How much work did you have to do to write this speech, Rye?
Well, I actually collected a lot of ideas from different people and since last year that I got elected. So all year I've sort of been turning it around in my head of what the point of the student speaker was and what to incorporate in it. So it was a good amount of work, but
worth it?
Worth it.
Okay. Well, again, congratulations.
Thank you.
Okay.
Take care.
Let's go now to Bill, who's with us from Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
Very good, thanks.
Good. Tomorrow's my last day. I teach, and I impart words to my students every year. One of the things I plan on saying tomorrow is the Robert Frost poem, The Road Not Taken. Are you familiar with it?
I am familiar with it.
My favorite line, and this is what I've tried to impart to my students, is two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. And I think students need to hear that. Too many kids follow the line to money and riches, you know what I mean?
Bill, you're retiring after how many years?
Oh, I'm not retiring.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No. This is my 13th year of teaching, but tomorrow's my last day. I've got some medical things I have to take care of.
Okay, well, good luck.
Thank you.
Oh, we appreciate it.
Have a good day.
Let's go now to Mark, who's with us from Ames, Iowa.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
What I wish somebody had said to me was, don't chase money. You know, do what you love, do what you're called to do, do it well, and the money will come. And I chased money for a long time and was unhappy. And finally, I decided to do what I wanted to do and what I was called to do and what I loved. And the money has come, and it's taken care of itself.
That's sort of the opposite of the famous Ivan Bosky, greed is good, advice that was given and immortalized in Wall Street. But
yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
Well, we also got this email from Sarah High, who just graduated from UCSB. My message to graduates would be, take whatever job you can get right now.
I think that's probably very apt advice now in this economy and very different than people graduating, let's say, four or five years ago into a very strong economy where the call for ignoring money may be easily followed.
Mark, what line of work did you find yourself more gratified in?
Believe it or not, as a lawyer.
Huh, okay.
I know that doesn't make sense maybe initially, but I also tried to chase money as a lawyer and was unhappy and finally decided that it was better to try and help people. And so that's what I felt called to do, and that's what I've had success at.
Well, good for you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Ken Baer, now, how personal can you get? I mean, I assume that's part
right.
of it, right?
Well, one of the big things is to remember that this whole day is about them and not about you. And when you're given a chance to talk for, say, 10, 12, 15 minutes to thousands of people, you usually want to talk about yourself. If you're, I think, an alumnus or alumna of a certain university, it's important to talk about changes that you've seen, and it's a natural thing, personal ties. The other thing to do is, if you're famous, people want to hear the things that happened in the backstory. You know, we all read the history books.
Sure.
But, you know, when you could start off a statement by saying, when I was playing backgammon with John and Bobby in the Oval Office, people perk up and want to listen. And as long as you don't do that by you don't fall into reciting your CV over and over again, I think it's important to give those glimpses of your fame.
Suggestion we got from Laura Domnick in Moreno Valley, California is, it's not the strongest of the species that survive, nor the most intelligent, but the most responsive to change. That from Charles Darwin, advice to a graduating class. Perhaps we're going to be taking more of your calls and emails. I'm sorry, did
maybe he spoke at the University of Galapagos
it
there.
Could have been, yes. Yeah, so, you know, a slow-moving class.
Exactly.
Right. We're going to have more of your suggestions and emails by phone, and we'll read them aloud if they come in on paper. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We need some themes for this speech. We're getting a lot of quotes, good advice, but we need some overlying theme. So email us or call us with those. We'll be back with those after the break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It's the season for commencement speeches, and today we're asking your help to write one. At the end of the program, we're going to deliver the address of the graduating class of Ought 3, so stay tuned for that. It should be interesting. Here's some inspiration.
Why are we here today? This is the question we must ask ourselves. Well, it's because we are going to graduate. That question was too easy. We must challenge ourselves.
I want to suggest to you that you dream big, that you work hard, that you learn daily, that you enjoy life. And let me explain why. Peter Drucker wrote in The Age of Discontinuities that the number one difference between Nobel Prize winners and other scientists is not IQ and it's not work ethic. The number one difference is that they ask bigger questions.
I had planned to offer you some useful investment advice, but my staff informed me that those of you who in recent years have been paying Harvard tuition must by now have little left to invest.
I sense that you will share a common dream, and in this dream, you will be late for class. Then you realize that you're having the final exam. And you open the test booklet, and you see something that resembles an amalgam of Sanskrit and calculus. You struggle to make sense of this stuff, and in this dream, some of you will just weep with despair, knowing you're bound to flunk and that the jig is up. And some of you will have this epiphany, incredible epiphany. You'll say, wait a minute. You'll shout and leap up, and you'll say to the astonished professor and everybody in the class, I don't have to take this freaking test because I already have my degree from San Jose State University.
Commencement speeches delivered by Evan Gregory, a student at Swarthmore College in 2001, former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, orating at the University of California, San Diego in 1998, Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan at Harvard in 1998, and from last year, novelist Amy Tan sending off the graduates of San Jose State University. With us here in Studio 3A is Kenneth Baer, a former speechwriter for Al Gore, currently a professional speechwriting consultant. If you have words you'd like to hear in an ideal commencement speech, give us a phone call. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. A relatively new name on the commencement circuit is poet, novelist, and filmmaker Sherman Alexie. In 1999, The New Yorker named him one of the top 20 writers for the 21st century. He's probably best known for the screenplay of the movie Smoke Signals, based on his collection of short stories, The Lone Ranger and Tonto Fistfight in Heaven. His latest book is called 10 Little Indians, and he joins us now from his office in Seattle, Washington, and thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be here. I'm getting nervous, though, listening to all this.
Now, you're set to deliver the commencement address at the University of Washington in June, and this will not be your first time giving a commencement address, but I understand it's the first time you're going to be addressing 40,000 people in a stadium.
Yeah, I gave the commencement speech at Columbia College in Chicago and Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, and those are small colleges, small artsy-fartsy colleges. And this is a huge public institution, so I'm very nervous about it. And it's one thing to give a speech in somebody else's town and then be able to leave before sundown if you're bad. But I'm giving one in my hometown, the place where I live. So for years, there could be thousands of graduates who see me on the streets and hunt me down because I ruined their graduation.
Now, given your experience, those at those two other commencement speeches, what works?
Oh, you know, people have said it before, but it is really about humor, about being entertaining. As a writer, I suppose it would be pretty easy for me to write something profound that when read later would be profound, but I'm not sure that sort of writing is going to work on a stage in front of that many people. So it's a balancing act between being, you know, humorous and profound, you hope, and being some sort of, you know, pseudo-intellectual up on stage. And that montage you just played was a pretty good example of how you can be serious and address serious themes, but at the same time be amusing and entertaining. So that's what you're always trying to do.
Well, how do you settle on a theme? I mean, I understand you've been asking friends, relatives, and people on the street what they might want to hear.
Yeah, I've been irritating everybody. What should I say? What do you want to say? So I was hoping to use this show here as some sort of Martha Stewart, you know, self-help commencement speech program for myself, because my friends and family don't want me to talk about it anymore. But I guess it is trying to find out what people thought was ideal. But, of course, what I'm dealing with is that everybody has a different version of what a commencement person should say. And I still really haven't come up with any ideas. In the end, I think it all comes down to that Dr. Seuss book, Oh, the Places You'll Go. And so maybe that should be required reading at every commencement.
I think it is.
So, yeah, it's a new executive order, you know, 999 Dr. Seuss.
Yeah, in fact, I was at my daughter's graduation earlier this year. And in fact, that was the theme used by her commencement speaker. So, I think that one's been used.
Okay.
All right. Well, what do you want to leave your audience with when they're finished? Do you want them to, you know, vividly remember some, you know, flash of inspiration? Or do you want them to go away saying, well, at least he wasn't awful?
I have high ambitions. You know, I think there's a decided lack of ceremony in American culture, certainly a decided lack of adulthood ceremonies. And I didn't go to my graduation. I've always regretted that. So I hope what I do is sacred. I would love to be the equivalent of a Jesuit priest delivering an incredible sermon to the congregation. So I would love for the graduates that day to walk away thinking that for 10 or 11 minutes, I was sacred and treated the moment with enough sacred energy and taught them a little something. So I have huge ambitions. And you know, I'm not treating this as something ordinary, because it's not. And in fact, in some ways, I think doing these is just as much for me as it is for anybody in the crowd.
That's interesting. What do you get out of it?
I get to feel like I belong. I get to feel be a part of the community, especially this one where I live. I get to feel connected to a tribe, to strangers, to these. People who come from widely different backgrounds. I know that's one of the things I'm going to celebrate is having the graduates look around and realize, well, you're looking at Democrats and Republicans and liberals and conservatives and immigrants and the indigenous. You're looking at, 75 countries and 50 states. And after you leave this place, you're going to fight each other for control over politics and culture and money. But the thing you're going to have to look back and remember is that we all did this in the same place. That we all worked so hard to get to this place, and that perhaps, hopefully, you'll look back on this day for the rest of your life and remember that the people you're battling with in your present life, deserve some respect for their accomplishment as well. So I don't want commencement to just be about celebrating any individual's accomplishment, as it is about celebrating an institution, a college, that really enables all sorts of people that transcend class and race and other illusionary and real divisions among us.
A couple of jokes, I think you're there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the first person in my family to ever go to college, let alone graduate from college, and everything I have in my career is due to college, is due to, Washington State University and Gonzaga University, and I know that. And I know that really doesn't happen anywhere else in the world the way it happens here, and I celebrate that. I mean, I'm a liberal, commie, pinko, pacifist guy, but I love this place. And I think the best of who we are is reflected in higher education. And I think it often gets a lot of blame and a lot of criticism, but I think we should be celebrating it in all of its forms.
Chairman Alexei, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And good luck.
Thanks.
Sherman Alexei, the author of Reservation Blues and Smoke Signals. His latest book, 10 Little Indians, and he was with us by phone from Seattle, Washington. And Ken Bear, it sounded like he was almost there.
It sounded like we were the testing ground for the University of Washington's commencement speech. It was very moving and very good stuff, very personal and yet applicable to everybody. You're right. A couple more jokes, he's there.
Yeah, passion. I guess passion is a part of it, if you have a reason to bring it in there.
Absolutely. Throw away the quote books, throw away the Nexus searches and the Google, and talk from what's from the heart. And that's always will be better than anything you could steal.
A couple of more emails. Be the generation that changes the world for a better world. No pressure here. That from Charles Laguat. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that, in Waycross, Georgia. I think the best advice is to look back on the past fondly, but assume the best times are always yet to come. Why limit yourself to 4 years of high school or college? That one from Yvonne Gibbs. And I guess, Ken, that's a way, you know, you always want to look back and then forward, right? The old Janus trick.
Right, right, exactly. You know, one way to look at this is that it's the academic equivalent of giving a St. Crispin's Day speech, like from Henry V.
And more into the breach.
Exactly. You need to rally the troops, and so they're ready to leave their comfortable surroundings of the ivied halls and the, you know, beer-soaked floors, and really go out into the world and, you know, make copies and get coffee.
Let's go now to Sue Ann, who joins us on the line from Minneapolis.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good. Thanks, Neil. I enjoy your show a lot.
Thank you.
It's raining like crazy here, so I hope you can hear me. I'm in my car.
Oh, no, we can hear you fine.
Good, good. You know, I'm the mother of three young adults, and I'm constantly trying to be profound with them and give them advice about the purpose and meaning of life. And I returned from a graduation ceremony last weekend in Northwest Kansas, and it was rather trite. The message from that speech was, you know, live to love and love to live.
Mm-hmm.
At the risk of sounding trite again, I just want to share with you something that my daughter, who's 16, painted on the back of her bedroom door. And it was very humbling for me because I thought it was rather profound. She painted a famous quote, and unfortunately I can't remember who said it, but it's she painted, the meaning of life is discovering your gifts, and the purpose of life is giving them away. And I thought that was really beautiful, and what good advice to give to any graduate.
That's beautiful. That's terrific stuff.
Isn't that amazing? And it was just so humbling for me coming from my daughter, and I thought, okay, I wish my name was under the quote, but it wasn't. Anyway, but that's okay. I'm just wanted to share that with you, and I was really proud of her when I saw that that was significant for her.
Ken, is that her quote?
No, she read it somewhere. She paints quotes all over her room.
I see. Well,
from significant people. So
that's a good one, Ken Bear. That's a good.
I think it's a very inspirational quote, and if it may be trite, but I never heard of it before.
Yeah, I love it, and I'm really proud of her that she found it significant enough to paint in her room.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, I see in her that she is doing that. She's discovering her gifts, and she wants to give them away.
Sort of a good concluding line. Thank you, Sue Ann.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Because you do have to find that line to wrap it all up, don't you, Ken?
Well, you need to find one line, but usually you want to have a build-up. You want to have like a – and you hear this in people talking where they have these very quick sort of repetitions of advice. So, you know, don't forget to call, you know, live and love, and you want to build up to a crescendo. And usually the fail-safe way to end that is to take the name of the college's sports team and end it with, like, you know, go Quakers, I went to Penn. And,
uh-huh.
And everyone will cheer because they'll hear that, and you'll think they're applauding you. But really they're applauding the sports team and the fact that it's over. So.
Two goals in life, says Christopher Brundage. Be happy and be useful. If you live a life where you please yourself and benefit others, that will be enough. Louis Pasteur suggests Jim Maxwell said, chance favors only the prepared mind. And this from Paul McEnroe, president of the Mohawk Valley Applied Technology Corporation, he tells us, 2,000 years ago, to be the richest person in the world, you needed to be a great warrior. 1,000 years ago, to be the richest person in the world, you needed to be king or pope. 100 years ago, to be the richest person in the world, you needed to be able to exploit natural resources. Today, the richest man in the world got there by brain power. You, too, have a brain. Think about it. Now, that's not great.
I'm going to steal it.
Okay, all right. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Rather than a famous person or an authority figure, some schools and colleges, as we've heard, have a tradition of ending the year with a speech from a peer, a student speaker. Brown University is among those institutions. On May 26th, Memorial Day, Martha Lackritz, a graduating senior majoring in comparative literature, will be one of two student orators chosen to address this year's graduating class. Over the past year, she's been working with the university archivist. Some of the documents she stumbled on in the archives were old commencement speeches by former student orators. And Martha Lackritz joins us now by phone from Queens in New York. And thanks very much for being with us.
Hi.
That's a long commute to Providence from Queens.
Yeah, my brother lives here. I'm visiting him.
Okay. How did you get interested in being the student orator?
I got interested originally just from working in the archives, being around all these old artifacts and papers and oddities. And I think I wanted to, it's a very unexploited resource in the school, and I wanted to share that with
Now, did you learn anything not to do from reading those old speeches?
Yeah. Unfortunately, I learned much more of what not to do reading old speeches, I think. I read over a lot of speeches, some 50 to 100 years old and some just from the past few years. And I think what I was kind of disappointed to see was that almost everyone started with, just 4 years ago, you know, I stepped on this campus for the first time, and now, you know, it's sort of things like that, and I was able to, they all sort of fit into two or three neat categories, I found. Mm-hmm. But, and then there were some really special ones.
Ken Baer said earlier that if you're a big celebrity, you know, it helps to get, you know, a little backstory, get personal. Does that work with student speeches from your experience reading these?
Yeah, I do think so. I also think one shouldn't, especially at like an Ivy League school where it's a bunch of overachievers, and I think one should sort of not resort to talking about his or her own personal accomplishments. You know, some of them would be like, you know, after being captain of the softball team for several years and volunteering with Clean Up America and tutoring handicapped children, I learned that, you know, stuff like that. And I think students find that kind of pompous or unnecessary.
Students are sometimes pretty bright.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do these speeches, I'm told you found that they fall into two themes. What are they?
Oh, yeah. From looking at the old ones, and one interesting thing was that I found that even ones from, like, you know, sort of World War II era, or even ones from a couple of years ago, were very similar. One category was it would be sort of very academic and use an old something that the person had learned in his or her concentration at school. For mm-hmm. instance, a classics major would write about, would create this allegory between, like, going out into the world and, you know, the accomplishments of, say, a Greek general or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then there would be the other kinds, which were just very much more broad and talked about, I came here and I was so naive and lost, and look at me now, and, you know, 4 years have made me wiser and different, and when I look back, you know, sort of like that.
Now, I'm told that a peer advised you not to pull a Hillary Clinton. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, I had a couple people said, don't pull a Hillary Clinton. And I've been meaning to look into that story. Apparently, they told me that, it was actually an alum from mm-hmm. Brown, who said that when she graduated from Wellesley, I guess it was, she had prepared a speech, and then when she got up on the podium, read something totally different that she had prepared, and I suppose that was somewhat of a scandal. I guess it depends on what you say.
Hmm.
But, you know, I sort of, I have a lot of respect for that. I think, I actually think that students would love that if a student got up there and just did something totally polemical and you know, sort of.
It's also an old rhetorical trick to, I'm throwing away this speech that I prepared, and here's what I really want to say. But anyway, good luck to you.
Thank you.
Martha Lakritz is a graduating senior majoring in comparative literature at Brown. On Memorial Day, she will be one of two student orators to address her graduating class. She joined us by phone from Queens, New York. We're crafting a commencement speech with your help. When we come back, commencement wisdom from a veteran author and historian, David McCullough. It's Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, join Ira Flatow on Science Friday for a look at the life of one of the last century's most famous scientists, Albert Einstein. Today, we're talking about the importance of commencement speeches and asking you to help us write one. It's coming down to crunch time in 9 minutes. We're going to actually have to deliver this speech. We don't have any quotes from Albert Einstein, amazingly enough. We did get one from Shakespeare, I guess, along with Robert Frost and Dr. Seuss, an eternal commencement favorite. To thine own self be true, that from Hamlet, suggested by M.G. of Jacksonville, Florida. Pat O'Hara of Pennington, New Jersey, suggested being is better than doing or having, from Thomas Merton. That's a good one. And John Kortbein from Minneapolis said the implied message of graduation is that you've learned all you need to know. Obviously, this is not the case, and people need to be encouraged to keep that fire of curiosity burning. Our guest here in Studio 3A is Kenneth Baer, a former speechwriter for Al Gore, currently a professional speechwriting consultant. We need your help at 800-989-8255. 855 or TOTN at NPR.org. But joining us now is historian David McCullough, the author of the winner of the Pulitzer Prize for the biography John Adams. He's also someone who knows a thing or two about commencement speeches. He's given a lot of them, too many to keep track of, according to him. He joins us now on the line from Thomaston, Maine. Thanks for being with us.
Very glad to be taking part in this.
Why do you give so many speeches?
Well, I'm invited to give them, and I love commencements. I think commencements are one of the few great ceremonies we have left in American life. We have very few ceremonial occasions each year, and they're such a celebration of hard work and of course, learning and moving on to make a better society. And it's such a wonderful gathering of people of all ages, from all backgrounds, from all parts of the country, all parts of the world. Everybody's happy. It's a tribute to accomplishment, and I am always honored to be asked to take part.
How many do you think you've done?
Oh, 20, 25, something like that.
I wondered, a commencement gathering, as you say, it's a very special group of people, but it's a unique gathering of people. It's a little like vaudeville. I mean, you're not ever going to address that same crowd again or work that same room again. Can you recycle your material?
No, I try not to do that. I try at the end of each, the last 3 or 4 minutes to give a certain, to address my remarks directly to the graduating class and to give them a few simple do's and don'ts that I think have weathered the test of time. But I try to make them different each time.
Okay. You've said you'd had strong opinions about what a commencement speech ought to be and ought not to be.
Yes.
Can you give us a for instance?
Well, I don't think there ought to be apologizing for make a speech to you that you're going to forget. I mean, that's just a cliche itself. It's self-evident. And I think it's a very short speech, or should be, and so your words and the focus ought to be very clearly thought out in advance.
About how long do you think?
Oh, 15 minutes at most, 12 minutes. And you ought to have a reason for getting up there and talking, not just filling the air. You ought to have something you really want to tell that audience. And it's an important audience because it's such a representative audience.
Now, are you giving a commencement speech this year?
I am, at Dartmouth.
Ah, so you're working on this now?
Yes, I am.
So what's the theme, if you can give it away? Nobody's listening from Dartmouth.
Well, the theme is that there's no such thing as a self-made man or woman. We're all the result of many people who've helped and guided and encouraged and inspired or reprimanded. And that as important as any of those people are our teachers, and that our teachers are the most important people in society. We've got to get over the idea of regarding them, considering them as sort of glorified babysitters who take care of our children while we're off doing the important work. They're the ones that are doing the most important work. And the difference between a good teacher and a so-so teacher, or a great teacher and a poor teacher, is the difference between night and day, or lightning and the lightning bug. We have to do a better job of teaching our teachers, because too many teachers are coming out of schools of education and not knowing any science or history or whatever it is they're assigned to teach. And it isn't just that we have to take teachers more seriously as members of society and show them more respect and affection and appreciation, but we have to take more interest in how they're being educated, because they have to do the most important job.
David McCullough, it's sound advice. Thank you very much for being with us today.
You're most welcome.
And good luck when you give your speech.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. David McCullough, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning biography, John Adams, and he was with us by phone from Thomaston, Maine. He pulled over the side of the road and went into a store there to get on the show. We appreciate that from him. Ravi Fry sent us an email. Life is hard, but no matter how hard your life becomes, never forget you have a unique ability to make things slightly better or dramatically worse. Ken, Bear, let's go to another caller. Lindsay joins us from New York City.
Yes, I'm just calling. Actually, I'm on my way to see my sister graduate from law school at Boston College, and I hope her commencement speaker is following your advice today.
Okay, I hope so, too.
I wanted to share two things. A kernel of inspiration for me. Someone said, you know, when you're picking this career, and you've been talking about this job and career, think about what you liked best when you were 10, because you don't change that much. And when I was 10, I learned how to process black and white film in the dark room, and I just loved it. And now I'm a photojournalist, and that really struck a chord with me. But my very first front page picture was a picture of Kurt Vonnegut, who was speaking at Syracuse University, my alma mater. And he was not our commencement speaker. He had been a commencement speaker before and strongly encouraged not to give the address he had prepared, which I think advocated turning the Carrier Dome into housing for the homeless. And so he gave the speech he wanted to give when he was invited back by the speakers board, you know, to lecture at the college. And so he put on his mortarboard and he talked about good conversation in business and reading the encyclopedia. And he was talking about how he pretends he knows about Bismarck, but he doesn't. And he talked about the importance of writing letters because it makes him feel like he was feeding a big blue bullfrog. And I thought that was absolutely hilarious and pretty good for, you kind of have to hear him deliver it, for an opening joke that we were talking about. So then Kurt Vonnegut went on to record the song Always Wear Sunscreen. And so I always smile when I think about that. And I was really proud because it was my first published photograph. So
As a young reporter, I ran into Kurt Vonnegut at an event and asked him that really stupid question, gee, what are you doing here today? And he looked down at me and took a big puff on his cigarette and said, committing suicide by tobacco.
He's really great. He talked about how whenever he gets asked to run a contest for young writers, he sends the applications to, college work study and college cafeterias because the real writers are not in the creative writing program, which I think got a few boos from our English and textual studies guest at that lecture, but he's very funny, very dry. So that's my advice I can remember from Kurt Vonnegut.
Thanks very much, Lindsay.
You're welcome.
And congratulations to your daughter.
Sister.
Yes, that's it. All right, bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
That's good advice, isn't it, Ken?
It isn't. It is good advice, although not everyone's Kurt Vonnegut. So to try to be offbeat when you're, say, Kofi Annan would be kind of bizarre. Conan O'Brien, he had a very famous class day speech, which is the day before commencement at Harvard, which is very, very funny. But he's a funny guy, so you expect that.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've written for clients. One of the odd things of writing for other people is you have to find their voice, something they're comfortable with.
Right. You know, everyone sees the speechwriter as a puppeteer, or really a feedback loop. And the trick is to actually keep listening and interviewing your client over and over and over again and read what they've said in the past and just repackage it and sort of put the bells and whistles on. And so it looks very familiar to them and sounds familiar to them, and hopefully you can, find their voice. Of course, speechwriters become great mimics of the people they write for.
If they write for them consistently.
Exactly. Yeah. This is true.
Let's get a call from Walt, who joins us from Prineville, Oregon.
Hello.
Hi, Walt.
Hi, Neil. Well, I just wanted to share that I retired last spring after teaching high school in our community for 29 years. It's the same town I grew up in. I started to school here in 1952, and I retired in 2002. And my students asked me to speak at graduation, and I really turned them down about twice, and finally they kept begging. And a colleague said, well, just get up and do what you do. So I did. And I thanked them for coming and apologized. I didn't apologize, but I said, I'm here to talk to you students, I said, because most of the adults probably won't approve of what I have to say. And I said, you've asked for my advice? And I said, well, here it is. And I said, get out of Prineville. I said, go, leave. I don't care where you go or what you do, just leave. And I went into a total rant. And I ranted, about, go help us. Poor person, go to a country where people speak a different language or don't even look like you. Just get out of Prineville. And finally I slowed up and I stopped and I said, but then look, if you stop sometime on top of a mountain or maybe in the middle of a desert or maybe in love or maybe in a big city or maybe you stop and you're in jail. I said, it doesn't matter. I said, and you think about Prineville. I said, well, then come back to Prineville. Come back and bring the wisdom of all those experiences and adventures that you've had and make a difference in this community for the better. And I said, a lot of us will still be around here. And I said, have a nice journey. And I flipped him the peace sign and walked off the stage.
To thunderous applause, I'm sure.
Oh, it was incredible.
Walt, thanks very much.
Hey, you're very welcome.
That's a suggestion from Walt in Prineville, Oregon. And I'm told, by the way, Kurt Vonnegut did not record the sunscreen speech. So we'll get that, or the sunscreen line, always wear sunscreen. And then we want to thank our guest, Ken Baer, who's been with us here in Studio 3A, a former speechwriter for Al Gore. He's now a professional communications and speechwriting consultant. And appreciate your coming in today and giving us advice.
Thank you. It was great hearing everyone's contributions.
Now we're going to have to perform this speech, which is going to be...
As long as you write it.
Our colleague has been putting together all the thoughts that we've had. But we did, of course, get a quote from Einstein, since we mentioned we didn't get one. The hardest thing to understand in the world is income tax. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Chancellor Close, thank you for that flattering introduction. President Bishop, Vice President Goodwin, Dean Silva, members of the board, distinguished guests, and the class of 2003, thank you for allowing me to offer a few words to you on this auspicious day. When I found out I was going to speak with you today, I asked for a lot of advice about what I should say. And while people mentioned all sorts of possible themes, everyone had one key bit of advice: keep it short. It reminds me of what another commencement speaker said not so long ago. Commencement speakers are like a body at a wake, he said. They need you to have a party, but they don't need you very much. But there is something important we should talk about today. When I was in college many, many years ago, times were good. I didn't worry too much about whether I would get a job, but only what job I would get. Today, it's different. Times are tough. There's a lot of competition out there. So what do? Well, some people say, take the secure road. Take whatever job you can get right now. Or as one wag put it, get out there and get a job. You'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll make minimum wage. But I'm not sure that's the right way to go. Remember, security isn't everything. In fact, it might point you in the wrong direction. Charles Darwin taught us that the species most receptive to change are the ones that survive. As a favorite teacher once taught, change involves movement, movement involves friction, friction causes things to crumble, but, and this is an important but, friction is also what polishes gemstones. So better than the secure road is the one that lets you be true to yourself. Quit a few jobs and see the world. If you don't do it now, when will you do it? And then, when you get back, don't just get a job. Get a career. Find something you like to do and do it. Don't chase money. Do what you love, and the money will come to you. It won't be easy. Parents, there's a message here for you, too. You will need to support your kids, not necessarily financially, but in spirit. As a famous person once said, the meaning of life is discovering your kids, and the purpose of life is giving them away. But don't despair. This is the generation of the future. So graduates, don't waste this opportunity to do something for the world. Be the generation that changes it and teach the world that change is good and will help us all not only survive but grow and improve. Darwin was right. For the world to survive, it needs change, and it needs you to make it happen. And finally, I want to leave you with this thought. As you go through life, think often about your alma mater, because the Talk of the Nation School for Advanced Metaphysical Studies will always be thinking about you. And never forget our motto, nihil dictum quod non dictum prius. Nothing is said which has not been said before. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you so much. Go out into the world, go out and prosper. I'm Neil Conan, NPR News, in Washington.